Hello, everybody out there in podcast land, and welcome to the Front Row Flashbacks, a part of the Front Row Network and NPR Illinois Community Voices. I am Ryan Lutens, diehard horror fanboy and all-around Academy Awards snob.
I'm Jay Hoffman, master of the dad joke and interpretive dance.
And I'm Erin McCabe, the peacebringer and insightful mama hen of the show.
Here on Flashbacks, we like to get all nostalgia-like about the movies of our past. Movies from the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s that have shaped the way we look at cinema and pop culture today, and how those movies have given us insight and hope in our everyday lives.
So strap on your fanny packs.
Hold on to your butt.
And let's get ready to flashback. Ever taken a trip through time to battle space zombies for the fate of humanity's greatest discovery, all the while James Cromwell is getting drunk and doing some type of rhythmicing, well then you might be thinking of Star Trek First Contact. Thank you for joining us. We are here today. It's an epic episode because we have a great returnee back. I shouldn't say returnee. He's the guy that started this because we are talking Star Trek. It is his favorite. He's ready to geek out, but we'll save him for last. With me, as always, is Jay. Jay, how's it going?
As good as always, which is not very well.
Well, it's going to get better because we're going to talk First Contact, which is a great movie. Erin is not with us tonight. You know, things come up. So, Erin, we miss you terribly. You know, regardless of the fact that, you know, we miss Erin, we do have the original flashback host. The Godfather himself is here tonight. Scott McFarlane, how's it going?
I'm contractually obligated to do one of these every year, I think. So here I am.
Well, I'm glad that it was Star Trek because we know that Star Trek is one of your favorites. I can't wait to talk. You know, let's let you have the honor. Let's break down the story. What is First Contact all about? What's the rundown?
Sure. Space, the final frontier. This is a voyage of the Starship Enterprise, NCC 1701E, the most badass, most underused starship ever in Star Trek. Its roughly two-hour mission is to defeat the Borg twice, prevent the destruction of the humanity's first warp-capable ship, ensure first contact with the Vulcans, and keep Zefram Cochrane's hands off Counselor Troi. In an even-numbered Trek film before Nemesis, they will go boldly into their past and our future to create arguably the only rewatchable TNG film there is.
That's perfect, man. So you're telling me you're not a fan of Nemesis?
No. I'm assuming we'll do rankings later. I will talk later.
We will.
Let's talk about a good movie first.
Okay. But what if I want to talk about F. Murray Abraham as that thing in Insurrection?
No!
Right. Such a waste of talent. All right, let's move on. Okay, Jay, you have some big shoes to fill. Aaron's not here, but let's hear your best fun facts.
Fun facts. All right. Director, we've got Jonathan Frakes, number one. Writer, we throw Gene Roddenberry as the creator of Star Trek, but Rick Berman, Brandon Braga, and Ronald D. Moore. Cast, we've got the Patrick Stewart as Jean-Luc Picard, Jonathan Frakes as Riker, Brent Spinner as Data, LeVar Burton as Geordi LaForge, Michael Dorn as Worf, Gates McFadden as Beverly, and I didn't put her last name, so what's her last name, Scott?
Crusher.
Marina Sirtis as Troi, Alfred Woodard as Lily, James Cromwell as Zefram Cochrane, and Alice Krieg, I think, as the Borg Queen.
You nailed it. And you forgot Neil McDonough.
I didn't forget it. I felt like it was a smaller role.
Playing the guy who gets launched.
Plus, you had the script earlier. You could have put it in there, so shut it.
Well, I'm putting it in now.
I also didn't put Adam Scott, who is in this movie, for like 2 seconds. How crazy.
I missed that one.
We got Robert Picardo, the doctor from Voyager.
Yes.
I saw him.
Many you can list.
He's not a doorstop. budget for the movie was about $45 million. Opening weekend made about $30,700,000 and some change. Total gross in the United States was $92 million, and cumulative worldwide made about $146 million. Scott's pointing the finger at me, so.
I've got a fun fact to insert there real quick. So
you
it made
sing it. You need to sing it.
I don't know what did I do what you said, but it's cool. $30.7 million opening weekend. Roughly 15 bucks of that was Craig and myself going to see it. Opening weekend, it would have made an extra 15 bucks as Craig and I were in our parents' backseat driving home from some event we were at. And I said, hey, can you drop us off so we can go watch First Contact again? And my dad's like, yeah, sure. And then Craig had a seizure in the back of the car and we went to the ER. So we lost First Contact 15 bucks. Thanks, Craig. Good job.
Well, that's some Big Brother love right there. and of the 13 Star Trek movies, not 10, Ryan, looks like it's the seventh highest grossing. That was just on a random website I looked at, but I think the new three is probably what pushed it back some, since those were much more popcorn pleasing than maybe traditional
for stuff. Sure.
And Voyage Home still, if you do inflation rate, Voyage Home is still really high up there as well too.
It's for the whales, man.
It's the whales, yes.
Voyage Home, aka the whale one. Rotten Tomatoes score of 92%, audience score 89%, so pretty even in there.
So now this is my fun fact. Before the new ones came out, this one was the highest score out of the 10 before the Calvin timeline came out.
All right. So it was the highest. Then the new one came out. And
then people started watching Star Trek again. It was amazing for a while.
Yeah. awards actually had quite a few nominations, few wins. It did have an Academy Award nomination for Best Makeup. Saturn Awards, which really here on Flashbacks is like the award show that means something to us. Like every movie we watch is nominated and wins Saturn Awards. Was nominated for Best Science Fiction Film, Best Actor for Patrick Stewart, Best Director, Jonathan Frakes, Best Writer, Brandon Braga and Ronald Moore, Best Music, Jerry Goldsmith, Best Makeup, and Best Special Effects. It won 3 Saturn Awards, Best Supporting Actor, for Brent Spiner as Data, Best Supporting Actress, Alison Krieg as the Queen, and Best Costumes. And like I said, several other smaller awards that I wasn't as familiar with, but lots of nominations and a few other awards. Now, the USS Defiant, which is introduced on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, was built for the sole purpose of fighting and defeating the Borg. And this movie features the only time the ship fights the Borg. And he's wearing his shirt.
I have a USS Defiant shirt.
Perfect.
Designed by Benjamin Sisko at the Utopia Planitia Fleet Yards.
Wow, it is thick with nerd in here today.
When you bring back the Godfather, he brings a certain gravitas with him.
Is that what it's called? Okay.
Yeah.
Although his name is never given in this movie, according to Star Trek canon, the Vulcan who salutes Zefram Cochrane is named Solkar. As mentioned in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, Solkar is the grandfather of Sarek and subsequently the great-grandfather of Spock. The Borg Queen was created because the writers were having difficulty in writing dialogue for what was intended to be the Borg's central computer. And I know Scott's got some thoughts there.
Who, me?
You're hitting your head. It just seems rough. James Cromwell became the first actor in Star Trek history to actually utter the phrase Star Trek. Although in Star Trek Next Generation, All Good Things, Q says it's time to put an end to your trek through the stars. At the end of filming, actor and director Jonathan Frakes got the nickname Two Takes Frakes because of the efficiency of his style. James Cromwell once claimed that Zefram Cochrane was the closest of any of his roles to his personality in real life. He is not Farmer Hoggett in real life, which is, if you ask me, that's what I would have thought.
See, I want to go drinking with James Cromwell because that man can hold his liquor. It's great.
He really can. He can dance like no other.
He is a giant. He's like 6'10". He looks like a beanpole. He probably weighs 250 pounds. Screenwriter Ronald Moore picked the date of April 5th for First Contact simply because that was his son Jonathan's birthday.
So Jonathan Moore, if you're into this should be dropped on April 5th. Birthday.
There you go.
Did my internet wake up?
It did, but we got
it. You said happy Earth Day, which is kind of close.
Happy birthday, Jonathan. Happy First Contact.
As Zefram Cochrane's ship is taking off, a close-up of a button panel shows two adjacent buttons labeled TOS-3 and TOS-8. Zefram Cochrane was introduced in Star Trek, the original series, TOS, Metamorphosis, which was the 38th episode of the original series.
And so many a nerd have tried to make that episode work with this movie, and it just doesn't. You're Zefram Cochrane of Alpha Centauri. What?
He's from a different planet and everything, right?
Yes, he is.
And lastly, Jonathan Frakes directed 8 episodes of Star Trek Next Generation, 3 episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, 3 episodes of Voyager, Star Trek Insurrection, Star Trek Klingon the video game. I didn't even know they had directors.
That video game is fun.
2 episodes.
How did I know that you played it? How did I know?
It's a good game. It's one of those old QuickTime games where you just like watch a movie and you pick stuff. It's good.
Pick your own adventure. Well, and that actually kind of makes more sense that there would be a director to that.
Yeah.
2 episodes of Star Trek Picard and 6 episodes of Star Trek Discovery in addition to this movie. All saying this dude knows Star Trek, and that's why he was originally picked for this. They wanted a dude that knew Star Trek. And to me, that is super rad. He's not just like an actor there. Like, he lives it. He breathes it. And I think that's really cool.
Am I the only one that was waiting for him to say, no, it's fiction? Or, you know, from Fact or Fiction from Fox?
That meme has really exploded recently. And I used to watch that show for like the 5 episodes it was on. And I was like, this meme came back 20 years later. It's amazing.
Right. All right. Well, thank you for those fun facts. I appreciate it. I'm going to try to say as least as possible just because of the fact that my internet is being, you know, screwy as always. Thanks, MediaCom. That's not a plug for you. Let's dive into it. You know, here at Flashbacks, we always talk about our first memories. I'm going to go first. I just remember watching this movie. I remember seeing it on TV. I didn't recollection what it was. I never really fully invested into it until I got to college. And I knew somebody was into Star Trek, and he said, hey, watch this. So we went to the family video and watched it, and that's when I started watching all the other movies. I have seen all 13. I own the first 10 digitally. I own the physical copies of the Kelvin timeline. But yeah, First Contact is definitely one that stuck out. It was definitely a very good movie. You know, and Jay and I were talking about this. This is not one that you have to know really much of a backstory. It is a very straightforward movie with tie-ins to the Next Generation. But it just feels like a giant episode. It's very well done. Very straightforward. So those are my memories. Scott, we're going to save you for last. Jay, what are your first memory?
It would have been, I didn't see it in theaters, although I really wish I would have. It would have been probably immediately upon release to, this is 96. I guess it would probably been VHS still at the time. My house. So I'll give my Star Trek background a little bit. I'm not a Trekkie. Scott's like talking stuff and I'm like, oh, I'm lost, man. I would say a casual viewer. It was always a show. All the different iterations were always on in my house. And it was one of those things that sometimes you sit down and watch and sometimes you don't. So I knew all the characters from the Next Generation and watched Generations previous to this one. But I think we probably rented it the weekend it came out and watched it. And this is by far my favorite Star Trek. And I think it's probably because I am a casual viewer. It's not deep. There's hints at some of the lore, but it doesn't get so deep that a casual viewer can't get into this movie. And this movie is just freaking fun. This movie is pure fun. And I feel like there's two movies happening at once and they merge together so awesomely. There's the crew that's on Earth that's basically running through Back to the Future. And then there's the crew on the Enterprise that's basically living through Dawn of the Dead. And I never knew I wanted Back to the Future merged with Dawn of the Dead, but
it works.
All right, definitely high school.
Appreciate that. All right, Scott, we already got a little bit of your story. You know, I'm glad.
Well, that was after I watched it. That was before the second viewing. So to know my first impressions of First Contact, you kind of have to know my first impressions of Star Trek. I started watching Star Trek back to where I don't remember when I started watching Star Trek, if that makes sense. So my dad had the original series on Betamax before there was VHS. And had all the movies up to that point. And so I watched them religiously. I mean, on one Betamax tape, I had Transformers, the movie, 1986, and I had The Voyage Home. So when I watched one, I watched the other one, you know? But in terms of First Contact, actually, I knew it in the zeitgeist of myself long before the movie came out, because I went to Generations opening night. It was my first midnight showing ever as a kid back in 94, I think. So I was 11. And when this one was starting to be made, it had one of the first film websites. So I was sneaking onto the website in my media lab back in middle school keeping up to date on all the information coming out of it. There was a, believe it or not, back before there was really the internet, there was a big fan uproar about Zefram Cochran and the fact that how can you have Zefram Cochran on Earth, as I already joked about. So people were already kind of nerding out about it. But when it came out, I mean, I completely agree with Jay on this. I mean, it is one of the few, I would say this and probably 09, which is the first of the Abrams verses, and Voyage Home are the only three movies where you can sit a newbie down and say, you know nothing, watch this, you'll enjoy it. And I think that's why, up until the Abrams verse, Voyage Home and First Contact were the top best-selling movies, because anyone could watch them and rewatch them. And it continues to hold up to this day. And I'm really, you mentioned Jonathan Frakes' long list of directing stuff. And he's going to continue to do that because he's directing several episodes of Picard season 2 and Discovery season 4. And he's actually a cast member on Lower Decks. And if you haven't watched the cartoon Lower Decks, you should. It's not what you expect. I'm disappointed Jonathan Frakes didn't get more to direct. I think I'm blowing through the script right now, so I'll shut up. But when it comes to first impressions of this movie, it has a special place in my heart, because this was like, yes, I saw Generations in the theater, but this was the first one that it was a movie that I anticipated. I had part of the script that got leaked in front of me before the movie came out. I mean, I anticipated this movie when it came out, and it held up, which is great.
That's awesome. Thank you for that. Well, let's break it down. Let's talk about the things that we like. What are the takeaways when it comes to first contact? Scott, we'll talk about you. We'll go to you. What's your number one takeaway when it comes to this movie?
Well, I think Jay mentioned it already too, and that is it's two films. And that's the way it was written too. When these guys put it together, you got to realize Ronald D. Moore and Brandon Braga wrote the finale of TNG, All Good Things, which is arguably the best episode of TNG and one of the best episodes of Star Trek ever. They immediately went into writing Generations, the two of them, and then they immediately went into writing First Contact. So these guys were burned out. And so what they decided to do was really take two different stories and run with them and meld them together. And of course, who is the biggest bad in TNG? Well, you should have got Q, but whatever. You got Borg. And then they also had this idea brewing of going back in the past. It will save money on the budget. It will also give us something to look at that we hadn't looked at before. And so they kind of melded this together. And I think it works really well. So the fact that these guys who, and also while this is going on, they're also writing for Voyager. Brandon Braga is executive producer of Voyager TV show at the exact same time. Ronald D. Moore is a writer on both Deep Space Nine and Voyager. So I can't stress enough, this shouldn't have worked. This script should have failed because these guys were doing too much. And a lot of times Brandon Braga's scripts do fail, but this worked. And that strikes me.
Yeah, I mean, the story is definitely something that lends itself. I mean, you've got two separate stories. And like I said, it just feels like one giant episode. And I think the fact that there's two separate stories, you know, there's people on Earth and people on the ship, you know, it really lends itself to more vested interest. Jay, what are your thoughts when it comes to the script and the story?
Yeah. And what's great is these two different stories are happening. And literally, like, if you're on the story that's taking place on the Enterprise, you don't have a clue what's happening on Earth.
Right.
And the people that are on Earth don't really have a clue what's happening on the ship. So that's why they're not trying to entangle it too much. Like, one is going to affect the other and vice versa. And then it just kind of merges right at the end in such a great way. So it's interesting. Seems like a lot of times when people try to write multiple threads to a story like that, they just like try to connect them too much and it gets muddy and it gets sloppy. And things were just like, well, if they fail, the ship is gone and they're stuck in the timeline. If the Earth people fail, they never discover warp drive and history gets wiped, you know? So they each have to succeed to protect the other, but they don't need to know what's happening with one another. And I think that's what worked really well.
Yeah. Jay, why don't you give us another takeaway? What's something else that you enjoy?
I'm going to go with the effects. I told my wife, I was like, cause I watched it this morning. I'm super glad. I've been in like Godzilla mode, getting ready for Godzilla vs. Kong, watching as many Godzilla movies as I can. So that helped the effects too a little bit. But I told her, I was like, I was really expecting these to be dated. Side note, I just started a month and a half ago. I decided, hey, we're doing First Contact. I'm going to like try and watch every episode of TNG and move through the different series instead of just kind of casually doing it. And I'm on season one. Season one is like basically a low budget stage play. There's like hardly anything on the set. There's like the effects are rough. It's from, you know, 1987. So I was really expecting a dip in the effects, and the effects were phenomenal. They hold up unbelievably well. I could not believe how well they were holding up. So that's my takeaway.
I want to hop on that because I want to hop with you and say, like, the effects were excellent, but I think the best part about the effects is the use of practical effects. Not only was it, you know, some CGI, but the practical effects. Is that what you were talking about, Jay? Or
all the CGI was great, but it was minimal. There wasn't a ton of it.
There wasn't.
And they were clearly able to invest in it, but like the Borg stuff.
The Borg.
I loved how it looked. Literally, it's like these light displays you find at Spencer right. Gifts.
Like a nice
but
little
it
laser
worked.
Pointer.
But it like totally worked.
Well, right.
But I was like, I think I owned one of those.
They absolutely raided Spencer Gifts to make this back.
Right. They have like lava lamps in the background. It's great. But no, just like the practical effects, you know, like, you know, when Data, you know, his head is, you know, half of his face is flesh and then that part is gone. You know, you've got, you know, Hawks, you know, when his transformation of a Borg, you know, you just see the one side of him and they turn it and he's just all, it's like perfect. I mean, you know, they did a really good job and, you know, you can save a lot of money not doing that CGI stuff. I will say this, and this is going to go on my improvement, but I'll just say it now. But when the Vulcans landed, man, they really phoned it in on the CGI because that ship looked so two-dimensional.
But it wasn't CGI.
Oh, it wasn't?
This movie didn't use CGI models. It did a little bit in the battle scene at the beginning of the movie because there's so many ships in there.
Okay.
But most of this is practical.
So that they actually made that ship at the end?
That was a model that they okay. just...
Did they use cardboard? Because it just looked really...
I mean, this is the last time we actually have the big Enterprise
as
a full model. It's a mixture of model and insurrection and model and CGI. And then in Nemesis, it's complete CGI. And of course, in the new movies, it's CGI as well.
Yeah.
Most of this is practical effects made by ILM.
You want to share? I mean, I'm done. You want to share what you got for effects? What are your thoughts on the effects of this film?
Well, no, I'm sorry for interrupting
you. Oh, no, you're good. I was done.
Okay. You mentioned the makeup too. There's two big changes they make to the Borg in this movie. The one is the Queen, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But the other one is the ability for them basically to assimilate you immediately. That wasn't a thing in the TV show. It took a while. Like there's a scene in Best of Both Worlds where they are graphing stuff onto Picard. It takes a while. With this one, they have the little tendrils that come out and get you. I think that was a great idea. It adds to the zombie horror movie aspect of it. But also, because of that, it adds to the makeup and everything that's going on. Yes, there's a little bit of CGI put in, like when it pops out of Picard's face at the beginning of the movie, which, by the way, is the best jump scare Star Trek's ever going to throw at you. But most of it is, again, practical. And you mentioned it was nominated for Makeup Oscar. I had to look it up. It lost to Men in Black, so I'll allow it.
Right.
But really, between the Edgar suit and the Borg, it's close.
Yeah.
But no, special effects, I love the special effects in this film because it's really true the only time, again, going back to the model thing, this is the only Star Trek movie that we're going to get a big battle that isn't a CGI computer fest. Yes, you get some, and especially Wrath of Khan and Undiscovered Country, you get some of the battleships going back and forth. But this is the one where you get everything. And it makes sense. They really do go off the fact, and again, if you're a nerd, you know this, the last time the Borg were anywhere close to Earth was Wolf 359, and it wiped out most of the Federation fleet. And the reason why there is a Defiant, and the reason why there is a Sovereign-class Enterprise, yes, it's called the Sovereign-class, is because of the Borg. The Federation rebuilt itself and built itself for war because of the Borg. So, of course, if we're going to put the Borg in a big movie, we better damn well show the fleet that was built from it. So you get that big epic fight, which is only a few minutes long, but it's so fun.
Yes. And there's
so many different classes of ship in there. I mean, I'm a big fan of the Steam Runner myself, and you have no idea what that is, but it's a cool ship, and it's only in there for like a second, but there it is.
I'm a big fan of Worf going, perhaps today is a good day to die.
That's an absolute, as I've mentioned to you guys on the chat, Deep Space Nine is my Star Trek. It is. I mean, I started watching TNG when it came out, but I was like four, whatever it was. Deep Space Nine, I started watching from the pilot and ended with the finale, and I cried like a baby at the finale, and I still cry whenever I watch the finale. So when the Defiant showed up, and I knew the Defiant was going to be in there because, again, I spoiled myself in some of this stuff, but when the Defiant showed up, I cheered as a kid, and when Worf is in there, I'm just like, yeah, go, go, go! I love the Defiant. It's a tough little ship.
So I'm gonna say a takeaway of mine, and that's definitely the cast, but I'm not, you know, you've got the TNG, you've got that original group, the crew, and I'm glad that they brought Michael Dorn back as Worf, you know, and you know, on his ship and him coming and joining the Enterprise, but bring in, you know, three big name actors, and just they just fit so well. You've got Alfre Woodard, you've got James Cromwell, and you've got Alice Krieg. And I say this constantly on this show, you know, a movie is only as good as its villain. And Alice Krieg is freaking fantastic in this. You know, and James Cromwell, I've never seen him act this comical in my life, but when you're playing a drunk who is a genius, it works. But like when he's sitting in the cockpit and he's like, ah, it just works. But you know, Alfre Woodard, you know, she's a great actress. But what I really want to say here is just, you know, you have the chemistry of the TNG crew, but the chemistry with these minor characters is flawless. And each of them have a pair. You know, Patrick Stewart and Alfred Woodard almost have a romantic relationship. And by the end of the movie, you're rooting for it and it doesn't happen. You're like, son of a bitch. So there's that. You've got Jonathan Frakes and James Cromwell. You know, you mix in a little bit of LeVar Burton, and that just works, you know, especially as Zefram Cochrane is realizing that he's bit this, you know, huge hero and he wants nothing to do with it. I mean, he played it so well. And the chemistry of everybody else building him up was fantastic. But Alex Krieg and Brett Spinner, their chemistry was frightening. It was so frightening because it was so good. Data's character, you know, Data, he's a computer, he's a robot, he's an android, and he's about to be a simulator, but it's not that easy. And she's just playing him slowly. And you're like, what's going to happen? It's very tense to watch, and it works so well for this movie. And I think that's why it works so well. What are you guys' thoughts when it comes to the cast, new and old? I will go with Scott.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. They knocked it out of the park with everybody here. And really, Star Trek does that a lot. I mean, if you watch the shows, they get some really good guest stars, and not even guest stars, but just extras. The guys who are in there, and a lot of them turn into main characters because of people just loving them. Jeffrey Combs was a one-off, and they actually killed him in the episode in Deep Space Nine, and they made up a way to bring him back through cloning just because they like Jeffrey Combs. You know, stuff like that. So Star Trek's really good about finding those really good casts. You mentioned Brent Spiner. I think this is the last time we get really good character development for Data until Star Trek Picard. And I won't say it because some people haven't watched Star Trek Picard yet, but in Insurrection and in Nemesis, I think they take a step back. They realize the writers decided, okay, I don't know how to write for Data with emotions. In First Contact, he turns them off, but it makes sense for him to do it at that point. The rest of the time, they're just like, I don't know how to write for him. So they don't do much with him. So I love the fact that Brent Spiner's got some time to shine here in this one. Alice Krieg is great in it. I still have issues with the queen itself, but the way she acts is great. And Zefram Cochrane, I mean, he makes this film for me. James Cromwell, he's Zefram Cochrane to me. But, because you already mentioned it, but the idea of having this guy who everyone has built up, it's like Caesar. For hundreds of years, people have looked up to this guy and made this guy into like a monument of a person. He's no longer a man. But then when you find him, he's a drunk who's trying to get some money after World War III and trying not to irradiate himself in the process. That's all he is. And you see him build up to where he's still not the amazing myth of a man, but he's able to just become enough of a person to kickstart, which is the golden age of human society and galactic society. It's nice that they decided that he didn't have to be somebody good. It just had to be a person in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. Well said. Jay, what are your thoughts when it comes to the cast?
Yeah, I liked Alice Krieg a lot. Just the makeup, and she's all slimy, and then throw in her performance in there, which, I think it would be difficult. I read that they could only do takes for a very brief amount of time before they'd have to take breaks because of the discomfort that she was in. But it's weird. She's real gross looking, yet she gives this really sensual performance, and it's like this really weird horror, man, it's like a horror movie thing going on, and I dug it. Once again, you get into the lore, that's where Scott's gonna go give his piece, probably under improvements, but just as a performance, I thought it was really good. Alfred Woodard, I had to look her name up. She's in so many movies. Yep. I'm like, who? I know this lady. Who is this lady? And I had to look her name up. I'm like, how did I not know
she's
her
in
name?
Scrooge, she's in, with Bill Murray.
Yeah, she's in everything, man. She's in every. You will recognize it. Google her. You
of
don't
all
know
the
name.
You're gonna
look
pull. Of all things you're gonna pull, you pulled Scrooge.
Why not?
That's awesome.
And then, yeah, like you said, James Cromwell. I think, for me, when I think back of him, I think of two roles, and they could not be more polar opposites. I think Farmer Hoggett and Babe, and then I think this. And I think that's interesting. You know, really shows the diversity of his range, these two roles. Man, this is my favorite. I love him in this movie. It was, I don't know, Babe as a kid was such, it really is like a big movie, impactful movie. And that's like, man, it was like ingrained in my head that that's who it was. And then I watched this. I was like, what is happening? This is not, you are not the stern professional farmer Hoggett that I know. So he's phenomenal in it. But since we're on takeaways, I do want to riff off of what Scott was saying, though, about the whole storyline around Zefram, you know, being this mythical figure. Everyone from the crew that's on Earth wants to shake his hand and get a picture, and, you know, all the celebrity stuff. And he's like, you know, this small little outpost in their bar. He's like the local drunk and the local genius, you know, in one. And
one-stop shop.
But it's this interest, that storyline, obviously I didn't catch any of that stuff when I was a kid at all, you know, it was right over my head. But now as I get older, you know, we talk about this, Aaron, who's not with us, she's miss emotion on things. And, you know, the things she gets emotional on, I'm like, oh, whatever. But like stories like this, like I have a screwed up emotional thing going on. but like things like this, as I get older, things about legacy, what you do with your time here, like, dude, that stuff hits me right here. I was like, oh, this storyline's making me feel weird inside. I liked how first when he went into space and he was just like, holy cow. And then he saw the Enterprise out the window and his whole attitude, like through his acting too, you could see his whole demeanor and purpose changed like in that second. And I thought that was really cool. And he did something for money, but he realized it was so much bigger than he ever even fathomed.
Can you imagine how history would be a little different if important people got to see what happens after the fact? Because most important people don't get to see what's happened, their legacy. And right. The idea that he's able to see that what I just did becomes that.
Right. And that's, yeah, that's huge.
Oh, man, I'm getting them goosebumps right now, man.
Don't try to be a great man. Just be a man and let history make its own judgments.
Who said that?
What idiot said that?
Zefram Cochran. But actually not in a timey loopy thing.
Right.
We don't know who said it.
Now he knows he's got to say it.
There's a couple episodes of Enterprise that play with that whole thing. Like, is First Contact the main timeline? Or is it a new timeline? Or did it always happen that way? Was it always this way?
I was thinking some of that when it was.
I did too. Like, are we having a Back to the Future moment?
But I did love how Riker used that his own quote against him.
Yeah,
brilliant.
Before we move on, does anybody else have any takeaways that they want to address? We talked facts, talked story, talked cast. One thing I want to say is just the tone in general in this movie. That's another takeaway for me. You've got a horror tone. You've got sci-fi. You've got, you know, action. I mean, this movie really does a great job of bringing all these tones together. You know, so that merits being said, because it's a movie. It's a fun blockbuster flick that ties in a lot of different genres in an hour and 45 minutes. Anybody have any thoughts on those?
It's definitely the only horror Star Trek movie.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on. Let's talk about we're gonna keep Impact. We're gonna let Scott talk Impact after we do our rankings. So let's just jump into improvements. What improvements would you want to see out of arguably the best Star Trek film? Jay, we'll start with you.
This is a small one, but this really irritated me. Help me out. Who's the actor I didn't name? You got all mad.
Neil McDonough.
The scene where he gets assimilated really annoys me.
Why?
Because they're in space and he's wearing a space suit. Like, he's just like the Borg dude just carries him off and then he's like, welcome back. Here's my Borg friend. Like,
Nanites, man. Nanites.
All he had to do was just, you know, insert three tubes in him and he was a Borg. It's pretty simple.
He had his whole half his face and the equipment on it.
Again, this is a change they made for the movie that at least it looks cool.
Yeah, it looked cool. But I was like, and why'd they go over the hill to do it?
You didn't know if that Borg had spare parts on the other side of that ridge, okay?
He's like, hang on, I'm losing teammates. Let me get one here real quick.
Anybody have acetylene torch?
I think that, and then one other, and I think this is more of just a 90s thing. When Picard in the beginning is having that dream that he's in, it's that like weird camera angle where it's like kind of floating and I don't like the camera shot that they used. Once again, these are like very specific things, and that was a lot of 90s movies, and I don't like the camera shot that they use, because I think it was like supposed to feel scary and it just feels kind of lame to me.
It's valid.
Because I love that shot. I love the fisheye lens. I think it's fun. I hear you.
So we're gonna wait to see Scott's improvements. But
I've only said it four times already.
Right. I'm just gonna go back to the whole ship thing, the whole Vulcan ship. Now Scott did inform me that it was an actual practical effect, but you know, if you have this, you're culminating to this point. You know, and this is what everything boils down to, and the ship looks very lackluster. You're just kind of like, meh. You know, you don't feel, you know, the spectacle of seeing that Vulcan ship with the human or the people on Earth that are seeing it for the first time with Zepron Cocker, and he just kind of loses its allure. But that's as poorly made as your internet. So it's pretty shitty if you're that saying something. All right, Scott, go ahead.
I wasn't the first one to drop an S-bomb.
That's all right. You're welcome. Go ahead, Scott. What improvements would you have, even though you said it four times?
Yeah, I said it four times. Again, they made two major changes to the Borg to fit the movie. The first one is an issue for one of you already, and that is the fast assimilation. I think that makes it scarier. And it makes it easier to, like, you know, don't let them touch you. But the other one they made is the queen. In TNG, it really was a collective. It was a hive mind. And the scary thing about the Borg was they didn't care about your individuality. They didn't care. All they wanted was your biological and technological distinctiveness. That's it. So they are just going to envelop you. And the reason why the Borg were so scary in most of TNG, it kind of falls apart in season 6 and 7. But the reason why they're so scary is because they cannot be negotiated with. They cannot be talked to. It doesn't matter what you think or what you want. And so when they decided that they had to have a big villain and have somebody that Picard and Data could square off against, they decided to do this queen. And in this movie, it actually is okay. I mean, part of that is because Alice Krieg is great in it, and she does really well. And everything you guys have all said, I agree with. She made me have weird feelings in the movie theater at a young age. But the issue I have is it really is actually long-term after this movie, I guess, which is kind of, you know, whatever. But it ruins the Borg, because now in Voyager, which is really Borg heavy, especially in seasons 4 and on, they're no longer a threat. It's just a mustache twirly bad guy with a whole bunch of drones. And I really wish they would have taken a little extra time, which they didn't have, but I wish they would have taken a little extra time to figure out how to make the collective scary for a movie. I think they could have pulled it off, especially Ronald D. Moore. I think he is an extremely good writer who's continuing to write really good stuff to this day. He could have pulled it off if he had a few more months to doctor this script. And I think it would have been better, not only for this movie, but for the franchise as a whole. So that's my biggest complaint about the movie.
Yeah. My wife really loves he's doing Outlander right now, right?
Well, he's doing everything right now. He's working on a development deal with Disney to make different shows about the Magic Kingdom.
Oh yeah. I saw Yep.
A mansion show and a Jungle Cruise show and a,
yep.
He does it.
He's doing Outlander.
He's most well known outside of Star Trek, and Outlander's big too. He's most well known runner for Battlestar.
Yep. That's how I know him.
Yeah. Which really, Battlestar was an answer to Voyager. He didn't like the way Voyager didn't get any scratches on it. And so he made Battlestar.
Which had a lot of scratches. All right. Is there anything else that we want to talk about in terms of improvements for a near perfect Star Trek movie? I think that's it.
I wish they would have continued to be perfect.
Right. So let's jump into it and talk about ranking.
Oh, yes.
Yep. Here we go. Sequel and ranking. So this is movie number 8.
Yes.
8 out of the whole kit and caboodle. So this is actually a sequel, but it is number 2 of the Next Generation films. So,
and it's the first one that is purely TNG. They don't have TOS.
Right.
Spock and McCoy to back them up.
Okay, so do we call this the first one of TNG and all the others are sequels?
I don't look at that way.
Theory. It's all one giant extended.
It's time. One franchise for me. I mean, yeah. So,
if you're a
TNG fan, I can definitely see where you see this is the beginning of the films and Generations too. But if you're me, it all kind of is one blob of franchise.
Yeah. All right. So this is how we're gonna do this, because we're gonna let Scott go last because he is the epitome of knowledge. He is our Trekkie go to person. Me as a casual viewer, I am going to just keep it to the Next Generation cast. Jay, I don't know, what are you going to do that, or do you want to throw in what you know?
Put the ones I know.
Okay, so I could try to do that, but I have not gone back and watched all the TOS, the original series movies. So, I was trying to say what I liked, but and I completely screwed that up last night when talking to Jay and Scott. So I'm just going to go first. First Contact is the best when it comes to the Next Generation movies. I would almost put that in when we're talking the 10, not the Calvin timeline. When I'm talking the 10, it's probably 2 or 3 in terms of a giant overview. But yeah, First Contact, then the Next Generation. And I actually like Nemesis. I know Nemesis is a terrible movie. Like, it's bad.
It's not just terrible, it's terrible.
Yeah, terrible. But Tom Hardy as a young Jean-Luc Picard, and just the fighting in that, where I think Insurrection, it's a lot of political. It's there's not a whole lot of fighting. It's mainly political and Insurrection. So that's why Insurrection, even though it has a very good villain in F. Murray Abraham, it's still last on my list. So First Contact, Generations, Nemesis, and then Insurrection. Jay, go ahead.
So some of this is faint memories from childhood, because I have not watched any of the original. Yeah,
I don't want to make Scott angry. That's why I didn't say anything.
Hey, man, I still got my thoughts.
I just correct you when you're wrong. It's okay.
Right, so I'm
going to
take that step back.
Just don't have a shitty opinion, buddy. Well, I already know I've got clearance, because he's like, yeah, those are good. Okay, perfect. My memory's okay. And it's like, it's just little things that I remember of those movies, but they stuck with me, right? It's like little stuff that like really stuck with me. And it's one of them's a goofy reason. But First Contact is my favorite, bar none. That's, it's my favorite. And like I said, I think if you're a casual viewer, it's going to be up there for you, I think. Next, honestly, I'm going to go with one just because I'm more familiar with Generations. I actually really like Generations. I like the idea. The only two of the first 10 that I own are Generations and First Contact. I really like both of them. So I like Generations. And then I think I've got to go Voyage Home, because like you said, that's everybody knows. If you don't know the name of it, it's the big joke, right? It's the whale one. But everybody likes that one. And it's fun. I like the idea. you gotta save the whales, man. And then get the name right. Undiscovered Country. We'll go with that one. And
I just called that the Christopher Plummer one.
I just say Klingons, blood floating in space. I'm in. I don't know why that the scenes where there's fighting, that is like such a vivid like thing that I remember from that movie, and thinking it, I was like, this is the coolest thing ever.
there's an interesting thing about that too. One of the reasons why it's so visceral is because the blood is purplish pink. And the reason why they did that was because they couldn't get away with a PG 13 rating and have it be red. So they had to change it to pink blue. And I think it had pink purple, and it makes it even more visceral now than when you watch it.
That's great. I don't know if you've, Ryan, what's that horror documentary about the '80s? We Are the Darkness.
In Search of Darkness.
In Search of Darkness. They talk about how a lot of 80s movies have green blood and blue, so they could lower their rating from R to PG-13 to increase. So that's interesting. Star Trek did a variation of
exact
that.
Same.
Then I got to go with I'll go with the J.J. Abrams first Star Trek that he did, and then Star Trek Beyond, and then Into Darkness.
What about the other two?
I don't like those.
Okay,
they don't get ranked. I don't like them,
so I don't remember. I barely remember anything about them, and I just said I'm never watching those again.
Well, that's what
I'll
sucks.
Just keep watching First Contact.
The TNG movies, like, they have two good ones and then two awful ones. Like, they're bad.
Wasn't that like the original ones is like, what is it, the odd numbers or the even number? The even numbers are the good ones.
Even numbers are the good and odd are the bad.
I'm about to argue that point, but yes, that's the thing. It's yes.
All right. For your definitive ranking, Scott McFarlane, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, as I mentioned, this is one big franchise to me, and I've seen them all way too many times. But there's only one movie that I will never watch again. And it's because it's that damn bad. And it's the only Star Trek movie I have ever booed in the theater when I watched it. And this was opening night with hundreds of people. I booed because it's bad. So we'll start there. Star Trek Into Darkness is the worst Star Trek film ever. It is anti-Trek and everything it is. I mentioned this to you guys in the chat. Unabashedly, and sometimes it loses its way, but really Star Trek is a humanistic show. The idea that at the end of the day, it's going to take World War III and 900 million of us are going to die, as First Contact tells us. But at the end of the day, we're going to get better. We're going to improve. We're going to be more than what we are. And the better days are ahead of us. Gene Roddenberry was very clear on that. Oh, there's a lot of dystopian future. This is not that. Into Darkness doesn't agree with that. Into Darkness wants to be a Star Wars movie. And the whole idea of having Khan in there for no apparent reason and whitewashing Khan. And yes, I know Ricardo Montalban was not Indian, but he was at least Latino. And then the reason why I booed in that movie is they literally stole the script from Star Trek Wrath of Khan and copied and pasted it into the end of this movie. And they didn't earn it. Not only was it not an homage, it was bad parody. And so Into Darkness is this terrible movie. Moving on. Final Frontier is next on my lowest to highest list. I think Final Frontier is a bad movie. But and this is the one where Kirk finds God, for those who don't know. But it has its moments. Like the campfire scenes with Spock, McCoy, and Kirk, I still think those are the best of the three characters there. Just talking at a campfire, it's great. Nemesis is number three worst. And I think it's because, again, it didn't understand what Star Trek was. Your director, Stuart Baird, was an editor. And this was his real first directing gig, except for Executive Decision, where he killed Steven Seagal. But he actually didn't understand Star Trek to a point where he thought LeVar Burton was an alien because he had weird eyes. I'm making your movie. Okay. The motion picture, director's cut. And if you haven't seen the director's cut of the motion picture, I know it is called the slow motion picture by many. Watch the director's cut. It's actually really good. Robert Wise got to go back and remake the movie years later and recut it, edited it down, put some new special effects in. It looks really good. It's a good movie. If you get a chance to check it out, check out the director's cut of that.
Kind of like the original Snyder cut.
Oh shit!
No comment. I'm being upbeat and peppy today. I don't
number five. Bait. Number
didn't
five.
Take the bait. Didn't take the bait.
Don't need Batman killing people. Okay. So next, I would say Insurrection. So really, on the TNG stuff, we all kind of agree. Insurrection is a blah movie. It's got some fun ideas of the Federation not being the Federation, so our guys have to fight it. I just wish it would have been more than what it was. Generations is next. Again, this was the first one I saw in the theater opening night. I think it's a good film. It just isn't really high up on my list. Search for Spock, which is in between Wrath of Khan and the Whales. I love it because it is really, it really examines the dynamics of the original cast and how they would do anything for their friend. And I see this as part of a trilogy, 2, 3, and 4. 2 is about death. 3 is about finding a reason to live. And 4th is about living. And it's a really good trilogy of films. Star Trek 09, say what you will about the J.J. Abrams verse. It's in the Trek world, it's kind of a fight one way or the other. But I think it's a good movie. I think it's fun. But it also, again, it's the idea, right, that Star Trek is about improving ourselves. The Whale movie is next, Voyage Home. Great film. It's one of those ones where if you're not Star Trek fans, we said, you can sit down and watch. I would then put First Contact after that. Again, it's the best of the TNG films, bar none. And then I would say, actually, this is where my list is going to get weird compared to many Trekkies. I put Wrath of Khan next. So Wrath of Khan is my third favorite. And it's a wonderful movie, Shakespearean, great. I just didn't grow up with it. It came out in 1982. I wasn't born yet. I watched it a lot on Betamax and VHS, but it wasn't one of my movies. Then I would say Star Trek Beyond. Again, many people now look at the J.J. Abrams verse as bad, and Into Darkness is terrible. So it's shit terrible. I would agree with that. But Beyond is the only Star Trek movie that gives us the original series episode on the big screen. By the time the motion picture rolls around, Kirk is an admiral, everyone's in their 50s, and it's a different kind of story. This is the original cast in their prime doing an original series episode. And I'm just sad that it had to end this with this movie because Paramount didn't know how to market it. Anton Yelchin unfortunately passed away, which makes things hard to come back. I wish this would have been the start of the series with J.J. Abrams' verse rather than the end of it, because I think we could still be having really good movies right now. And the last one for me is my favorite Star Trek film, which is Undiscovered Country. Yes, the one with Christopher Plummer and the floating blood. I think it is an amazing movie, not just a Star Trek film, but a movie about the falling of the Berlin Wall and only Nixon can go to China. Kirk has had his entire life taken from him by the Klingons over the years. They've always been his biggest villain. They killed his son in cold blood. They destroyed his Enterprise. And at the end of the day, it's he who has to go out and find peace. And it's such a wonderful send-off to the original series cast with them flying off into the sunset. It's a wonderful movie. And Endgame stole the idea of the little signatures at the end of the franchise. So Avengers Endgame has the same little signatures at the end. That's my list. Hate me for it. Bring it on.
No hate whatsoever.
No, I'm talking to the Trekkies who may be listening. Oh. Hate me for it, because I didn't put Wrath of Khan at number one.
All right. Well, thank you for that ranking. Let's just talk about overall impact. You know, I'm just going to start off and say that, you know, the impact of this film, you know, A, Scott, you talked about it being, you know, a humanitarian type of series. And it really is. You know, it's that hope that, you know, there's always an opportunity to get along and strive, you know, to go out and be helpful to others, people of different, you know, alien races, whatever. But I really, overall, the impact of this movie, this is Star Trek has been going on since the 70s. You know, my mother, we were talking tonight at dinner, my mother was watching it, you know, in the 70s. And that's something that struck me. You know, and she just was rewatching all the old episodes when they were on TV Land. So, you know, this is something that I want to go back and do, you know, and I want to do it right. I want to try to watch as much as I can from the original series to, you know, Next Generation to Deep Space Nine, watch all the movies again, you know, but just think, like, you know, first movie came out in the 70s or 70s, right? Yeah. 78. And you 79. Just had...
It was an answer to Star Wars. It was 78 or 79.
And Star Trek Beyond was 2017?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's 50 years almost. Well, really, it's like 40, but I mean, it's still going strong. I mean, you've still got shows that are coming out. You know, you've got Discovery, and fans are loving Picard, but I'm not, I'll let Scott dive into that. But I mean, just the overall impact, like this changed the face of science fiction. And more importantly, it changed the face of science fiction TV. I think you would not have some of the science fiction shows we would have if it wasn't for Star Trek. Jay, what are your thoughts?
Was the original show, that was the 60s though, right?
It was the 60s. Yeah, that's why Beyond came out in the 50th anniversary year.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, if you go with the show even further 50. Back.
Yeah.
And I talked to my dad about it, and he was kind of sci-fi, you know, nerd back in his day. And he said, when it was on, he said, you know, you watch it now, it's goofy, you know, it's dated. He said, but when it came out, he's like, there wasn't anything remotely like it. He said, it was one of a kind on TV. And, you know, for me and what I was into, I had to watch it. So I think, you know, and like I said, that's why the shows were always on in my house. And that's why I had that familiarity. But like you said, it's so interesting that the first movie came out as an answer to Star Wars. Now there's this weird battle, Star Wars or Star Trek. And it doesn't even make, like, watching them both, like, how's there, one's fantasy and one is sci-fi. One takes place on Earth or with Earth, you know, and one takes place in wherever. So it's really goofy to me that there's even a rivalry. They're like two separate types of sci-fi. But moving into those newer shows, Paramount is really pushing the Star Trek stuff on their Paramount Plus. And like you said, there might be some thoughts on the J.J. Abrams Star Trek stuff not being as Star Trek-y as, you know, some purists may want, but I don't think we're getting all this new Star Trek stuff without it. I mean, I think it has rejuvenated it. And I've watched all of Picard. I've started Discovery. Picard's luckily it's only one season. It's the only one I've watched. Both of these shows are unbelievably gorgeous, and they even feel like movies themselves. Like Picard definitely feels like a 10 episode movie. It doesn't feel like a show. So now we're in the golden age of TV, and Star Trek is living up to that. You know, the storytelling and the, like you said, the humanitarian stuff of some of the other stuff's what made it work. Well, now we're getting some of that plus this like cinematic quality. I mean, it's freaking high art now, man. Like it is like all around really nice to look at. And I was obsessed with Picard myself. I couldn't stop watching it. And for time after it, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And once again, I'm not as well versed, but I knew Jean-Luc Picard enough. And once again, super interesting starting TNG because, man, Picard is a dick in that first season and he's kind of a dick in First Contact. I was like, wow, I don't remember him being like a jerk.
We're not blowing up the ship. Dude, we're gonna die. We don't.
No. Yeah, so I know I'm blabbing on, but I agree with you. It's huge impact. But I think Star Trek's one of these things that forever and ever it was like, you know, you're a nerd, right? Nerds. And now nerd culture's taken over and it's hip to be square now, right? I mean, I think it's part of pop culture now, not just a part of like a specific sect of, you know, nerddom that we fall in. So there's my spiel.
Well, now let's hear the impact from someone who is a devout Trekkie. Scott, what is the impact of and Star Trek?
Yeah, so first off, you know, since you mentioned Picard, and I think that's the most timely because Picard season two is going to start filming here pretty quick. I think obviously Picard lends a lot from First Contact, not just the story, but just in general. And Picard is defined by his interactions with the Borg. And yeah, you make a good point there where Picard's kind of a dick in season one of TNG. I think if you're going to watch anything before you watch First Contact, I would recommend you watch Best of Both Worlds 1 and 2, as well as the episode immediately after that called Family. because it really shows that Picard is dealing with severe PTSD after dealing with the Borg, and the fact that the Borg took away his consciousness and made him kill hundreds of thousands of people slave. And so the next episode, he's really contemplating giving up Starfleet. Really, all of the stuff you saw in Picard is kind of wrapped up in that episode of Family. Also, Family is a good episode if you're watching Generations, because in Generations, his nephew and his brother die off screen. You have no idea who these guys are. You meet them in Family. So if you haven't watched that episode, you really should. It's a great episode. And not many people talk about it because it's right after Best of Both Worlds. Woo, but I think those three episodes go together. But impact-wise, there's a lot of toxicity online right now, and there has been since Discovery came out. And there's a lot of people on YouTube who believe that Trek is dead. And I think it's just funny to say that because there are millions of more people watching Star Trek than ever before. And yeah, Discovery Season 1 wasn't my cup of tea. Discovery Season 2 was a much better. And Discovery Season 3 is, I think, some of the best Trek we've had in a long time. And Picard is great. I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with Picard in Season 2. I mentioned Lower Decks if you want to have a fun, just a weird cartoon for a few episodes. It's fun and good. And it has a lot of Easter eggs and callbacks for us nerds. And then coming up next year, actually maybe this year, Star Trek Prodigy, which was actually a cartoon designed for Nickelodeon. It's going to show up on Paramount Plus instead, but it's for kids. Literally, it's a show for kids. We haven't had that ever. And then the show I'm most excited about, which I joked about this with the guys in the chat yesterday. If you would have told me that Captain Pike, the guy who showed up in a wheelchair for two episodes of TOS and had to talk with blinking lights, was going to become my favorite captain ever, I would tell you you're crazy. But Discovery Season 2 did it. And it wasn't just me, because of Discovery Season 2, we're getting Strange New Worlds, which is a show based on the Enterprise about 7 or 8 years before Kirk shows up. So it's Spock, Pike, and Number One, who we never got to really meet except for the pilot episode of the original series. And I'm extremely looking forward to that because they're saying that it's going to go ahead.
That's Anson Mount, right? Playing Pike?
Yes, Anson Mount.
Freaking love him. He is great. Hell on Wheels.
Jay, you haven't got the Season 2 yet. When they introduce Pike, it is just, even if you like Season 1, more power to you, but when they introduce Pike in Season 2, it is just a breath of fresh air. He even, because of what happens in Season 1, and I won't spoil it because you're watching it now, some stuff goes down in Season 1 that really makes the crew question everything. He comes in immediately and says, I'm not that guy. I'm the captain now. Here we go. Let's get some stuff done. He throws up on the bridge screen his failure grades from the academy and says, look, I failed astrobiology or whatever. God, let's just go. And I love Pike beyond belief. And the fact that we're getting Strange New Worlds here soon, they started filming a couple weeks ago. Star Trek is alive and well. And I think First Contact helped that because it brought in a new generation, just like Voyage Home brought in a new generation. Just like Discovery and Picard and Strange New Worlds are bringing a new generation. And it's maybe not all your cup of tea, but we don't have to be toxic about it. It's all Star Trek, except for Into Darkness. That one sucks.
Can I ask a question? Do you think the toxicity is purely not liking the stuff, or do you think it's we had this thing and now a bunch more people
are starting to like it now?
Honestly, I think it is inherent sexism and man-childness. If I could really vent on this for a while, but I won't. I think a lot of people in nerd culture, geek culture, they are, for lack of a better term, those quintessential guys who live in basements and never got out of their basement. And so that there's a black girl leading a show of Star Trek, they don't like that. That there's a Star Trek that has weird looking cartoon aliens. They don't like that. I really think it's the same idiots who complained about Sisko as a black captain in Deep Space Nine and the same idiots who complained about Janeway as a female captain in Voyager. The only difference is now we have YouTube and Twitter. And so they're amplified. And I think we just need to ignore those idiots because they are damaging to not only pop culture, but they're damaging to our culture. I mean, there's some sick stuff that floats around YouTube that people say, I'm a Trek fan and this stuff is crap because of X, Y, and Z. I just watched it. It's like, it's the same crap they gave Rey in Star Wars. Say what you will about the new Star Wars movies, but it wasn't Rey's fault those movies didn't pan out the way they did. But because she's a girl, we have a problem. It's incel nonsense and so annoying.
Yeah, I was just intrigued as because Paramount, I think, is going to keep leaning in on this. And
it is their flagship again. And the best thing that happened to Star Trek is really inside baseball. CBS and Paramount split apart back in the 80s, I believe. So Paramount owned the rights to the movies. CBS owned the rights to TV. And you couldn't intertwine those. Now Paramount and CBS have come together again as one company. So it is all one big chessboard. So I'm looking forward to seeing a shared universe like we haven't seen before.
I think Paramount Plus is definitely going to be a driving force. I mean, they're going to come out swinging. I mean, they've got competitors, but I think they
are. Oh, he's freezing up. Oh, he froze up a little bit. You were saying they got competitors. Peacock's not one of them though, right?
No. they've got competitors, but I think they have that the ability to.
And oh, he's got to. You got to stop having thoughts.
My internet is stupid. Is here. I think
like, we get what you're saying, though. Keep going. Just do it quickly.
Okay, so back got contact. They have Nickelodeon, but the fact that they have Star Trek and the shows along with making movies, it's going to lead somewhere.
Yeah, I think Paramount's going to be a player, and I did not think that literally a month ago.
Me neither. I thought it was going to fall
flat. As I just complained about the incel idiots, they've announced a few weeks ago, and they've had a couple starts and stops. The next Star Trek film right now is being written by a screenwriter who wrote some episodes of season 3 of Discovery. She happens to be a minority woman. So have fun, kids, on YouTube. But so forward with a movie, there's a question of if it's going to go straight to streaming service or if it's going to go to theaters, but we are going to get a movie sooner or later. And I think Star Trek inherently is a TV property, but the movies are great too. So,
mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I agree.
Well, that's going to do it for us here on Flashbacks. So let's go ahead and do our wrap up. What do we got coming up? Scott.
We got me not being able to hit my mute button. That's what we got. That's okay. I did my one contractual obligated episode of Flashback per year. So you may not get me again. But I will say that I'm still with the front row when I'm, you know, not moving to different states and taking on new jobs and everything else. We really do hope to get Zonozodes back for those who weren't around 4 years ago when we were doing it. We're looking forward to kind of jumping in again and starting to talk about the best TV property ever, Twilight Zone. But in terms of what you guys are going to do, as my script tells me, later this month, you will get all cannibalistic with Silence of the Lambs for its 30th anniversary. Then we kick May off with the great coming-of-age tale Stand By Me, which has one of the only TNG characters that doesn't show up in First Contact.
And I gotta say, while watching season one, that didn't make me mad.
you should, if you haven't followed Will Wheaton online, he's actually a prolific online guy.
He's great. I love him.
Watch some stuff he's talked about with his experience with TNG, because he was a Trek fan when he got the job, and you'll get to like Will Wheaton a lot more as a person than you will.
Yeah. Well, he's also my favorite book narrator, like for audiobooks.
Oh, yeah.
He did the Ernest Klein books, and he's awesome. But man,
let's not talk about Ready Player Two.
Yeah, well, I haven't heard that one, and I think I'll avoid it. Other things we got, Front Row Flashbacks. We're going to be taking over Full Disclosure a couple times this month, and one will already be out after this episode. Go back and listen to Godzilla versus Kong, but also we're going to face off in A Tale of Mortal Kombat. We're covering the original as well as the new one, so get ready for me to get a flawless victory over Ryan and just dunk all over him over and over again.
That's because you refuse to talk about Annihilation.
Kong is better.
All right, so I'm just going to read what Jay wrote because I think he gets me. Award season is the best. I'm a huge nerd. Anthony Hopkins and The Father is the greatest thing since sliced bread. Lots of award coverage coming up. No, but in reality, Oscar season is next month, April. So we are going to do category breakdowns. Of course, our usual spreadsheet of Oscar guesses. So just be on the lookout, though, for that. So, yeah, lots of fun. But in signing off, I just want to wish everybody a happy First Contact Day, as this should be dropping on April 5th. So happy First Contact Day. We love this movie here on the Front Row. But always remember that when it comes to being a flashback listener, resistance is futile.
Thank you for listening to Front Row Flashbacks, and make sure to tell your friends to check us out. Our pod is on any number of podcast apps, so look us up and please subscribe. While you're at it, if you really dig what we do, please join us as a full-time patron. Our Patreon link is in the show notes, and we would love for you to give us your money. I mean, to be a part of the team.
And be sure to look up the Front Row Network for any of our other content, like Front Row Classics, with hosts Brandon Davis and Eric Flick. Hold on a minute. We've got a guy on this podcast with the last name Flick.
He legally changed it for the show because that's the dedication we bring people at the Front Row Network.
Well, that's amazing. And just as amazing as some of our other shows, such as Guilty Pleasures, hosted by Lou Hare, and our Beyond the Mouse crew that covers all things Disney and so much more.
In short, we have something for everyone at the Front Row Network. Make sure you find the Front Row Network on Facebook and subscribe to our main feed on Spotify or whatever you use to access your podcast. We can also be found on NPR Illinois' website under Community Voices, and you can follow us on Twitter at Front Row Reviews with a Z. For the Front Row Flashbacks, this has been Ryan Lutens,
Jay Hoffman,
and Aaron McCabe.
And we will see you all in the front row.